You're watching Network Radio. Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful, I'm just a patsy, and we will be.
You ready to make to come to the microphone so they'll listen up?
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal. Where I'm very pleased this evening to have as my featured guest, James Perloff, who's a bit of a gadfly. He's interested in a vast range of issues, including false flags, which you'll be discussing with me tonight. His most recent book, The Shadows of Power on the Council of Foreign Relations and the American Decline, is available at Amazon.com and other bookstores. James, it's a real pleasure to have you on The Real Deal.
Thank you, James. It's a pleasure to be working with you. I know that you know a great deal about what's going on in the world. Just to clarify, The Shadows of Power is not my latest. It came out 27 years ago, but it's still selling pretty good. And my latest book is actually called Truth is a Lonely Warrior.
Actually, you're right. We finished with Truth is a Lonely Warrior as we proceed through the slide set, James. So thanks for that clarification. How'd you become interested in false flag events?
Well, I'd have to say that, I've been writing on them for some time. I started writing for the New American in 1985, and I wrote my first article cover story on Pearl Harbor for them in 1986, so that goes back 30 years. I didn't recognize 9/11 as a false flag the day it happened, but as the evidence began to accumulate, I saw what was happening, and it soon became apparent that this country has been brought into wars repeatedly through false flags. And the reason that we're going to discuss false flags tonight is that one of the big problems that 9/11 truthers run into when they talk about 9/11 is people say, well, our government would never do that to us. Well, our government would do that to us. And the importance of having an historical context is to show people, yes, this has happened repeatedly over and over again.
In American history, yes, that the U.S. government has pulled this stunt on the American people again and again in our history since the late 1800s. I think you're right on target.
Yeah, so what we could do is we could start with 1898 and the sinking of the Maine. And I know, Chance, we've got a picture of the wreckage of the Maine. And our
if everyone hasn't seen the cover of James' book, The Shadows of Power, you can show that briefly, Chance, and then turn to slide number two.
Okay, so what I want to do is first just give the general historical context as is presented in mainstream media. 1898, the U.S. battleship Maine sailed into Havana Harbor. It was there for about 3 weeks. On February the 15th, it blew to bits. 266 sailors were killed. And Cuba at that time was a colony of Spain. And we proceeded into the Spanish-American War with the battle cry, "Remember the Maine." And I guess you could advance the next slide there, Chance. We kind of threw these slides together, me and Dr. Fetzer, at the last minute. The full battle cry, though, was "Remember the Maine" and "To hell with Spain." And what they're really trying to do, I think, was to bring up that patriotic feeling of "Remember the Alamo." But
my understanding, James, was that there was actually no evidence that the Cubans were responsible for the explosion, that it could have been a problem with the boiler, but that it was capitalized by the Hearst newspapers, among others, to fan the flames that led to the Spanish-American War.
Yeah. And let me just define that war. This was a war that broke out after the sinking of the Maine, And I should mention that prior to this, anti-Spanish feelings, it was not against the Cubans, it was against the Spanish who controlled Cuba. They had been their colony since 1511. And you're quite right, it was William Randolph Hearst and the Yellow Press. And I'm going to just read to you some headlines, because this technique is used over and over again. Fake atrocity stories, okay? Think of Kuwaiti incubator babies. Okay, this is 1896. William Randolph Hearst Journal had this headline. Quote, Cubans fed the sharks, cries heard at night. They are taken outside the harbor, and the silent ferryman comes back alone. Here's one from Joseph Pulitzer's New York World, which is the rival paper for Hearst's New York Journal. Quote, waited a hospital, more than 46 wounded Cubans butchered, unquote. Actually, there was no hospital in that area. Pulitzer's and Hearst's reporters rarely went out of the bars of Havana. Here's another one from Hearst's newspaper. Quote, butchered 300 Cuban women, defenseless prisoners shot down by Spanish soldiers. And 2 days before the Maine blew up, killing 266 American sailors, Hearst had been paying bribes to have the correspondence of the Spanish ambassador to America stolen. And he had a letter printed in his New York Journal, which quoted that letter. And the headline was, "The Worst Insult to the United States in Its History." And actually, it wasn't any big deal. The letter just said that McKinley was a low politician who catered to the jingoes of his party. It was not a big deal. But 2 days after that headline, "Worst Insult to America in Its History," the Maine blows up. I don't think it's a chance event. Now, I should mention, Jim, that there have been 6 formal investigations into the sinking of the Maine, and 3 concluded that it was from an external device like a mine, and 3 concluded that it was from an internal source such as a coal bunker fire, which I don't believe was the case, because I don't think this was any accident given the timing. And plus, no other warship of that era blew up from a coal bunker fire. This was a deliberate false flag. And the point that I would really like to stress, though, is that although we're not certain of exactly how the Maine was blown up, we know that the forward magazines blew up, but we don't know what touched them off. A little bit like building 7 of the World Trade Center, there's always these arguments about precisely what caused the buildings to come down. But what we do know is that Spain was about the last country on earth to want to sink the Maine. And let me just back that up. First of all, Spanish sailors risked their lives to save our men. They were cared for by Spanish doctors and nurses. And Spain was bending over backwards to avoid this war with America. They had essentially a wooden navy. We had a steel navy. Now, if you know anything about the Spanish-American War, you know there were 2 major naval engagements. One was at Santiago in Cuba, and Santiago Bay, and the other was in Manila of the Philippines. And we destroyed their Asiatic and Caribbean fleets. We not only lost no ships, we only suffered 1 casualty in each of those engagements. And one of those casualties was from a heart attack. And so we had massive firepower they did not have. The commander of their Caribbean squadron, Admiral Severa, said, "We have nothing to fight with. They were in disrepair." Also, to fight in Cuba, this was essentially fought in Cuba, this war. Spain had to travel 4,000 miles. We had to travel 100 miles. They did not want a war with America. And they were caving into every American demand. We demanded that their governor, General Valeriano Weyler, leave Cuba. They conceded to that demand. We said we want democracy for the people of Cuba. So Spain said, fine, we'll have a relationship with Cuba like Britain has with Canada. We'll give them a voting legislature. But so they had no motive to provoke us. They did not want to fight the mighty United States and lose a war. But so when you look at these events, Jim, like a police detective, you look at who's got motive. And in this case, Cuba, by the 19th century, it became the wealthiest colony in the world, and it was the world's biggest sugar producer. And the Rockefellers' National City Bank had their eyes on it. The Rockefellers, of course, controlled Standard Oil, which they called black gold. Sugar in the 19th century was called white gold. So this is a very desirable object. And as a matter of fact, National Citibank got control of Cuba's sugar industry. And Chance, if you want to just advance to the next slide, we have a picture of it's an ad, a magazine ad from National Citibank of New York about the glories of Cuban sugar. They took it over after the war. And let me just give you a quote from Mark Twain. This is one of many quotes on the realities of this war. Quote, how our hearts burned with indignation against the atrocious Spaniards. But when the smoke was over and the dead buried, it suddenly dawned on the people that the cause of the Spanish-American War was the price of sugar, unquote, Mark Twain. This war, you know, it's so similar to modern wars. We're told it's for freedom and democracy, but it's really for the banksters. And guess how America got the money to fight the Spanish-American War? National Citibank kindly loaned us $200 million to fight the war. And, of course, that was another motive. We had to pay the interest on that loan. And believe it or not, Jim, there was no income tax then. So to repay the loan to National Citibank, there was a telephone use tax levied on the American people, and it stayed in place for 104 years. That's no joke. Just Google Spanish-American War telephone tax, 104 years before they finally took that away. The White House was under Wall Street control, just as it is today. The president was McKinley. He'd been bailed out of bankruptcy by the Rockefellers when he was governor of Ohio. Of course, Standard Oil was headquartered in Ohio. And then John Hanna was John D. Rockefeller's high school classmate, became McKinley's political manager, and lived in the White House. He was in the White House directing him, just as Edward Mandelhaus directed Wilson. Well, I'm carrying on for a while, Jim, so let me throw this back to you. But this is very much a typical false flag, false motive, done for the banksters war.
Oh, I think it's a terrific example, James. I'm very pleased you used it. The Veracruz may be a slightly variation on the theme if we go to the next slide, Chance. These are the ships steaming toward Veracruz. Tell us what this was all about, James.
Okay. Veracruz, we should mention, this is an incident people have largely forgotten because it was overshadowed by World War I, which immediately followed it. But 1914, there was something called the Tampico incident. And actually, when our sailors were arrested by Iran recently, I was wondering if the establishment was going to replay that incident. What happened was, in 1914, some U.S. sailors landed in the port of Tampico in Mexico, and they did so in violation of the city's port rules. So they were arrested, and they were returned to their ship unharmed within 24 hours. But the admiral down there, who's actually in this photo in the lower left, Rear Admiral Henry Mayo, demanded that Mexico apologize and fire a 21-gun salute in atonement to the United States, a 21-gun salute to our flag. He said, raise our flag and fire a 21-gun salute. So the Mexicans gave a written apology, but they said, we are not going to fire a 21-gun salute to the Stars and Stripes. We haven't done anything that merits that. Well, believe it or not, President Woodrow Wilson had the U.S. Marines, you can see the ship steaming down there, invade Veracruz under the public pretext that America had been dishonored by Mexico by their refusal to fire a salute to our flag.
How ridiculous. Slide number six, Chance. Yeah, this is simply obscene, James. So there we are marching through Veracruz.
Right. The U.S. Marines came in. They killed at least 150 Mexican soldiers, plus many civilians. And by the way, I know you know Smedley Butler, who wrote War's a Racket, the highest decorated Marine.
Two-time Congressional Medal of Honor winner.
Right. And he knew what was going on. He was given a medal for this action. He refused to wear it, and President Wilson ordered him to wear that medal. He wanted no part of this. So what we need to do now is to once again talk about the real motive. The real motive was not anything to do with the American flag. The real motive for the invasion of Veracruz was the banksters again. Mexico was being plundered of its oil by John D. Rockefeller's Standard Oil Company, and Mexico had a new president named Victoriano Huerta, who was unfriendly to Standard Oil. So John D. wanted to get rid of him. And that's why the troops invaded Veracruz. And within a few months of that occupation, he was forced to resign. And a new president came into Mexico who was friendly to Standard Oil.
Friendly to Standard Oil, James. What a remarkable development.
Yeah. So you'll go back. You see a lot of similarity to the Spanish-American War, again, being done on behalf of the Rockefellers. Really, the Spanish-American War was the first war where our military was, or American people were convinced that our military's duty was not just self-defense, but to go and fight wars on other people's behalf. But it's always on the bankster's behalf, and Veracruz is just one more example of that, one more deception, one more surface excuse given to the people when their real motive is the one that is with the people who are controlling the president from behind the scenes.
Excellent. Slide number 7, of course, represents one of the catastrophes leading to World War I, namely the sinking of the Lusitania. Do tell us about it, James.
All right. We'll spend a little bit more time on this. I want to give people the context again. In 1915, when the Lusitania went down, World War I was in full swing. You had the Central Powers fighting the Allies. Britain was among the Allies, and they wanted America to come into the war on their side. There were people on both sides of the Atlantic who wanted to see this happen. But America had no reason to join World War I, and so a pretext had to be created. The Lusitania was a British passenger ship. It was torpedoed by a U-boat in the South China Sea, and it was struck by a single torpedo.
Slide number 8, Chance.
Yeah, that will show us the path of the ships and the U-20 being the U-boat. The Lusitania went down in just 18 minutes. Even though it was a huge ship, it was actually the largest ship afloat when it was launched in 1906. Now, the American public was told a typical story. Look, the ship was just minding its own business. The Germans sank it because they wanted to kill a lot of innocent women and children. Now, they wanted an immediate declaration of war. They did not get it because the American people just weren't buying yet. But this was the event that triggered a series of diplomatic exchanges between Germany and America that ultimately led to the declaration of war.
Slide 9, Chance. And, of course, as I understand it, James, in fact, the Lusitania was carrying weapons in its hold and therefore was actually a legitimate target for a U-2 attack.
That's exactly correct. Here's what was on board the Lusitania besides women and children that the American public wasn't told. There were 173 tons of rifle cartridges, over 50 tons of shrapnel shells. There were 46 tons of aluminum powder, which was an explosive which the British used in their military. By the way, it was illegal to send passengers on a ship with explosives. There were 20 cases of mercury fulminate, which is a very powerful explosive. And there were unnumbered tons of gun cotton, which the British used in their mines, sea mines, and other explosives. I say unnumbered because on the ship's manifest, it was disguised as things like butter and furs and other items because the British were trying to disguise what was actually on board the ship. Now, the torpedo hit the forward cargo hold. There was a massive explosion. That's why the ship went down in 18 minutes after a single torpedo hit. The explosion was obviously from these munitions detonating. I would just advise people be cautious of some of the modern mainstream books that say it blew up from a boiler room exploding. Sailors survived from all three operational boiler rooms that day. If the boiler room had gone, there would have been no survivors, but there were no survivors above the cargo hold. That's what blew up. So don't buy into that story. The book you see there in that slide, The Lusitania by Colin Simpson, it was published in 1972, but I regard it as the most authoritative book on the Lusitania. Now, together with the fact that the Germans had justification for sinking this ship, I want to mention a couple of other things. One is foreknowledge of this attack. I'm going to give you a couple of quotes. There's many more. If you go to my website, jamesperloff.com, I've got articles on just about all these wars. The one on Lusitania is called False Flag at Sea. But here's a quote from our ambassador to England, Walter Hines Page, May the 2nd, 1915, 5 days before the Lusitania was sunk. He said this in a letter to his son, quote, "If a British liner full of American passengers be blown up. What will Uncle Sam do? That's what's going to happen, unquote. And let me give you another one. This is from Edward Mandelhaus, who I'm sure many of your listeners know was Woodrow Wilson's Wall Street controller. He lived right in the White House, and he picked his cabinet for him. House was conveniently in England the day that the Lusitania sunk. And that very morning, he met with Sir Edward Grey, who was a British foreign minister. And here's what we read in The Intimate Papers of Colonel House by Charles Seymour's Skull and Bones. It's a biography of Edward Mandelhaus. House wrote, quote, "We spoke of the probability of an ocean liner being sunk, and I told him if this were done, a flame of indignation would sweep across America, which would in itself probably carry us into the war," unquote. Later that day, House and Grey went over to Buckingham Palace, and they met with King George V. Now I'm quoting House again, quote, "We felt it talking, strangely enough, of the probability of Germany sinking a transatlantic liner. He," meaning the king, "said, suppose they should sink the Lusitania with American passengers on board," unquote. Now, that quote is from about 2 hours before the ship went down.
Repeat the quote, James.
The king of England said, "Suppose they should sink the Lusitania with American passengers on board." Obviously, England is looking for a way to get America into the war. These quotes that I'm giving you, they're only a sampling, but they cannot have been by chance.
Are we even sure it was a German U-boat that sank the Lusitania?
Well, yes, the German U-boat admitted that, and we have the German U-boat's logbook where it put a single torpedo, right into the hold, the forward cargo hold of the ship. So that I'd say I know there's been some speculation that a British sub torpedoed at the same time, but I haven't seen any convincing evidence.
Well, it looks as though the British had a more powerful motive than the Germans.
They did, but the Germans did have a motive because they did not want those weapons to reach the European front.
Germans knew the actual contents of the holds of the Lusitania.
Well, they had a pretty good idea because there were a lot of German-American dock workers in New York who were loading the ship. I should mention the Lusitania was making ship trips back and forth with these munitions. This was not the first time. It was a regular cargo trips being made from New York to Liverpool, and I should add that there were troops on board this from Canada as well, disguised as civilians, the day the Lusitania went down.
And of course, the propaganda had it that the Germans were simply sinking innocent passengers aboard a passenger liner that had nothing to do with the war.
Well, that's always the case. It's always, we were minding our own business, and these villains came along and attacked us for no reason. Same thing with the Maine. We're minding our own business. What was the Maine doing in Havana Harbor in the first place? It was not our territory. They said it was a friendly visit, but how friendly is a battleship? And they said it was to protect American interests. Well, there were a few Americans living in Cuba, but how's a battleship going to protect them? You know, the battleship was there for one reason, which was to be sunk. But back to the Lusitania, there's one last thing I want to say about that, which was this was a setup. The British Admiralty, which was then under the control of Winston Churchill, sent the Lusitania directly into the path of a U-boat. Now, how did they know a U-boat was going to be there? Two ways. Number one, Britain had cracked Germany's naval code. And so when a U-boat would surface and radio Germany, Britain would read and decipher the text. The second thing was that the U-20 had sunk two steamers in that same location the previous day, the South China Sea. So they knew from those reports that the sub was there. And in Churchill's map room, they actually had it mapped out with the Lusitania on a collision course with the U-20. But I'm going to give you what I consider a very significant quote. This is from Patrick Beasley. Here's his book. Patrick Beasley, the leading authority on the history of British naval intelligence. He was in British naval intelligence. He was the guy who had moved the pieces on Churchill's map. Okay, so he knew what he was talking about. Here's the quote. Quote, "Nothing. Absolutely nothing was done to ensure the liner's safe arrival. I am reluctantly driven to the conclusion that there was a conspiracy deliberately to put the Lusitania at risk in the hopes that even an abortive attack on her would bring the United States into the war. Such a conspiracy could not have been put into effect without Winston Churchill's express permission and approval," unquote. Patrick Beasley, British Naval Intelligence. See, we're not the only guys who use the word conspiracy, Dr. Fetzer.
Of course, conspiracy is the most frequently prosecuted crime across the country. Conspiracy to defraud, conspiracy to commit burglary, conspiracy to commit murder. Mm-hmm. Also attack, you know, students who are critics of the government accounts and exposing their inadequacy are labeled conspiracy theorists to try to shift the burden of proof, as though we had an obligation to establish what actually had happened in every detail, or otherwise have no idea what we're speaking about. And as you well know, it was introduced by the CIA in response to critics of the Warren Commission to try to stereotype and discredit them in a superficial fashion.
Well, you're right. They try to put the burden of proof on us. Let me just say that the burden of proof has been met by us. I just want to clarify one thing Beasley said in that quote. He said nothing was done to ensure the liner's safe arrival. What he means by that is that no destroyers were sent to escort the Lusitania, which was standard procedure. Normally, the Lusitania was escorted by destroyers. On the day it was sunk, there were four destroyers lying idle in the nearby port of Milford Haven. They were just kept there in dock instead of going out to escort the ship. They basically did everything they could to make sure that ship went down.
I think those are excellent points, James. Excellent points. Now we turn to an even more spectacular occasion of our entrance into World War II, where slide 10 shows the attack by the Japanese on Pearl Harbor.
Right. And if you don't mind, Jim, what I want to do is I want to draw a little continuity between World War I and World War II, and just in terms of the motives.
Yes.
Because, you know, there's always the public motives. World War I established world government in form of the League of Nations. As you know, this whole Illuminati globalist cabal wants world government. That's the ultimate goal. World War II, which Pearl Harbor got us into, established the UN, League of Nations, the UN. World War III would get us into a full-fledged world government, an antichrist world government, if you will. World War I established the first communist state, the USSR. World War II expanded communism over the whole globe. World War III would create a communist-style police state, a Stalinist-style police state over the whole world. World War I gave us the Balfour Declaration, whereby Britain pledged to Lord Walter Rothschild to create a homeland for the Jews in Palestine. World War II created the State of Israel. World War III would generate Greater Israel as the capital of world government, which has been the Rothschild's dream. In terms of civil liberties, World War I created the Espionage and Sedition Act, under which hundreds of Americans were prosecuted, and not one of them was a German spy. It was just for protesting the war. World War II created the Great Sedition Trial. It was ridiculous. People were charged with being Japanese agents just because they were against the war. And, of course, World War III, if it happened, would give us a full-fledged FEMA camp situation where anybody who was against what was happening. Of course, it was also the typical war profiteering. World War I, Bernard Baruch and his buddies made $6 billion in war profits for munitions that were not even delivered to the front. That was discovered by the post-war Graham Committee of Congress. Of course, World War II, again, profiteering. And, of course, you have that continuing today with the military-industrial complex. I should mention, I think that's enough of the just the continuity that – between World War I, World War II, and World War III, there's a genuine continuum of motives of what we see unfolding before us. And each of these wars is helping to advance these causes.
I'm interested in your use of the word communism here. Tell me more of what you mean by that.
Well, communism can be said today in the classic sense that nobody talks about Karl Marx anymore, but I'm really talking about the totalitarian state under Lenin, Trotsky, the Gulag state under Stalin. That's what I'm referring to, the Iron Curtain at its worst.
Encroaching national military police, fascistic dictatorships, I think, is very close to what you're capturing here.
That's what I'm talking about, totalitarianism. It doesn't.
Authoritarian forms of government where the government is increasingly powerful and the citizens increasingly under their control and domination.
Absolutely. I don't think in a final world government that they would refer to it as communist. They would use another term, but it would be a police state in the best emulation of someone like Stalin, even worse.
may return to this at the end, but I think the Trans-Pacific Partnership may represent the coming New World Order if they can get it in place. It is going to decimate the Constitution and create a North American Union, in effect, where borders and sovereignty no longer matter.
That's right. They're trying to attract us with these trade deals, saying it'll make us more prosperous. We always lose jobs in manufacturing as a result. And you're absolutely right. When we join these international trade alliances, we become subject to international trade organizations like the World Trade Organization, and the Constitution is overridden. You're right. These are sovereignty-destroying trade deals that are designed to create world government.
Yeah, and even under my most charitable interpretation of the administrations of Bill Clinton, he brought us NAFTA and the WTO, which have been catastrophic in destroying our manufacturing and industrial base.
Yes, you're right on target. And if I may say so, they're really trying to emulate the European Union. The European Union started with a common market, where it's sold as a simple economic arrangement. NAFTA is supposed to emulate that, becoming a North American Union. These are regional stepping stones towards their ultimate goal, which is a world government.
And look where the U.S. is today versus where we were, say, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, our economic viability has deteriorated. We have virtually no manufacturing or industrial base. There's poverty enveloping this once great nation, James. It's tragic and taking place before our very eyes.
Your eyes are really open, speaking of eyes, to that situation. As a matter of fact, at the end of World War II, we only depended on imports for 2% of our products. We're manufacturing everything, but our textile industry has been wiped out, our steel electronics industry virtually wiped out by cheap foreign imports from these global trade agreements.
Stunning stuff. Well, here we have the opening act of World War II in terms of the American involvement with the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Tell us about it, James.
Exactly. Of course, just to give people context, if you have some younger viewers, December 7th, 1941, Japan attacked our fleet at Pearl Harbor. We had 18 ships sunk or heavily damaged. We had over 2,000 dead.
Now, let's go to slide number 11, Chance, so that, you know, James is describing the arrangement of the ships and so forth.
Yes, and that arrangement is very, very important. This is the event that, of course, that brought us into World War II. And I want to make a few points. Now, this is not a classic false flag. We were attacked, but this was an orchestrated event. And let me talk about that. A lot of people never ask the question, why was the fleet in Pearl Harbor in the first place? And the answer is, it was a presidential order. It was not a naval decision. It was made by President Roosevelt to station the fleet in Pearl Harbor instead of its normal berthing on the U.S. West Coast. It was normally down around San Diego. And when that happened, the fleet commander, Admiral J.O. Richardson, flew to Washington in a rage, and he gave the president a list of reasons why the fleet should not be based in Pearl Harbor. Number one, in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii is surrounded by uninhabited water, so you could launch a surprise attack from any direction, whereas if you kept it on the West Coast, a surprise attack would be impossible. You'd run into all kinds of shipping before you hit the fleet. Number two, as you can see from the map, the fleet was boxed in like sardines, so they're ideal targets for bombers. Number three, to resupply the fleet, you had to go across 2,000 miles of the Pacific. Number four, being separated from their families would be bad for the Pacific Fleet's morale. Number five, 37% of Hawaii's population was ethnically Japanese. So since we had tense relations with Japan, why would you want to put it in a place where you were liable to espionage and sabotage? It made no sense. So
And number seven, we'd broken the Japanese code. Number eight, we knew they were going to attack us because we'd provoke it by cutting off their access to oil in the south. Number nine, it was a bait that the FDR set, a trap.
Yes.
In his Day of Deceit, does a brilliant job of outlining the circumstances of the attack on Pearl Harbor.
All of which are on my actual agenda. I was just going to mention that after this meeting with Roosevelt, J.O. Richardson was fired. And Roosevelt, the only reason he could give him for putting the fleet in Pearl Harbor is he said that it would deter Japanese aggression. Well, guess what, Jim? As of December the 7th, 1941, everybody knew that Roosevelt was wrong. It did not deter Japanese aggression.
On the contrary, he was baiting the trap.
He was baiting the trap, but he was never held accountable. It was always the Navy guys who were held responsible for this.
My father, who served in the Army in World War II, observed to me many times how the carriers, which are the kinds of ships we need to fight a war in the South Pacific, had been removed from Pearl Harbor before the attack on September 7th.
You're absolutely right. Roosevelt did not want to sacrifice the best equipment. He wanted to win the war. And actually, it's my understanding there were only about three engagements during the Second World War where we actually used battleships. They were considered outdated and too slow. We mostly relied on destroyers, cruisers, and aircraft carriers to win that war. You're right. They took the best ships out of Pearl before that attack occurred. I should mention, before we move on to the next event, I do want to talk a little about the foreknowledge of the attack, the breaking of the codes, as you were just talking about.
Why don't you go to slide 12, Chance, while we're talking about it? Go ahead, James.
Yeah, you in that next slide, you see the continuity. Remember the Maine, remember the Lusitania, remember Pearl Harbor. John Toland, I actually like that book more than any, but there are many books on Pearl Harbor. Going back to 1947, when you had Pearl Harbor by George Morgenstern.
Hold it back just a little bit. Let's see the cover again.
Okay.
Not quite as close. Down a little bit. Down a little bit.
Okay, sorry about that.
We can't quite see it, James, but go ahead anyway.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Well, let me see if I can do a little better job of holding the books. That's The Final Signet of Pearl Harbor by Rear Admiral Robert Theobald, who was in Pearl Harbor the day of the attack. And the one you mentioned, Day of Deceit by Robert Spinette. Many, many authors have documented this, but how did Roosevelt know the attack was coming? Well, first of all, he did provoke the attack. Just as you said, the oil embargo, we refused to lift that oil embargo despite many attempts by Japan to have it lifted. They were facing starvation, and we were demanding that they, as the only way we would lift the embargo is if they removed all their troops inside of Japan. Just imagine if somebody said the United States, we had to remove all their troops inside of America. They could not do that because they saw that communism was spreading on the Asian mainland, and they were concerned that if they withdrew all of their troops from the Asian mainland, that communism would spread over China, which of course it did after the war and ultimately resulted in the Korean and Vietnam conflicts. But in terms of foreknowledge, Japan communicated to its embassies through a code called the Purple Code. And we cracked that code in 1940. Some people say it was actually earlier, but we actually had a machine that could decipher that code, and we were reading their messages on a same-day basis, and those messages were promptly sent to key figures such as President Roosevelt, to the Army Chief of Staff George Marshall, and they even went to Harry Hopkins, who was nothing more than an unofficial advisor acting as a front man for Bernard Baruch. So the establishment on Wall Street always knew what Japan was planning, but they were not shared with the fleet commander, Admiral Husband Kimmel, or the army commander in Hawaii, Walter C. Short, unless Roosevelt wanted to. Now, what did these messages tell us? Well, they told us, for example, that the Japanese spies in Honolulu were telling Tokyo the exact locations of our ships in dock. Now, Jim, there's nothing unusual about spies watching ship movements, but when spies are telling the enemy the exact locations of your ships in dock, obviously, they've been targeted for destruction, but Roosevelt did not think that was important enough for the commanders in Hawaii to know. We actually decoded the declaration of war before we received it. Again, Hawaii did not get that information in time.
Yeah, of course. It was all deliberate on the part of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who believed that America should become involved in these wars and felt that this was the way to precipitate the support of the American people. And in his judgment, nothing else would actually accomplish that feat.
You're right. As a matter of fact, people had wised up to the Lusitania, and Roosevelt knew he needed more than one Lusitania. He needed a dozen Lusitanias, and that's what he got on Pearl Harbor Day. I should mention two other ways that he knew about the Pearl Harbor attack. He received several personal warnings, Jim. He was warned about the attack by Joseph Greer, our ambassador to Japan, from his sources. He was warned by J. Edgar Hoover, from information he got from a Yugoslavian double agent named Dusko Popov. You can find all of this, by the way, in the books I've referenced or in my article on my website, jamesperloff.com. It's called Pearl Harbor Roosevelt's 9/11. You'll find all the source information for this. He was also warned by Congressman Martin Dies, who received a Japanese map of the attack, by Senator Guy Gillette, who'd been warned of the attack, by the Dutch military attaché. The warnings just kept on coming in. Finally, you mentioned Robert Stinnett. Robert Stinnett proved through the Freedom of Information Act that we had cracked not only Japan's diplomatic code, we cracked their naval codes. And I'm going to read just one message that we intercepted.
Sure.
And that message is from Admiral Yamamoto to the Japanese First Air Fleet, November the 25th, 1941. Here's the quote. The task force, keeping its movement strictly secret and maintaining close guard against submarines and aircraft, shall advance into Hawaiian waters, and upon the very opening of hostilities shall attack the main force of the United States fleet and deal it a mortal blow. The first air raid is planned for the dawn of X day, exact date to be given by later order, unquote. Now, Jim, nobody could read that intercept and not know that we were going to be attacked, but that information was not shared with the sailors of Pearl Harbor.
Yes, yes, yes. The command in Pearl Harbor was kept in ignorance to be used as pawns for this Japanese attack to precipitate our entry into World War II.
Yes, and by the way, the commanders in Hawaii were scapegoated. And if you want to just tie that to 9/11 for a moment, Roosevelt scapegoated Kimmel and Short, tried to make it sound like they were guilty of dereliction of duty for not having known about the attack, that they didn't take adequate surveillance measures of the surrounding waters. They didn't have adequate surveillance planes. They were denied that. But the thing is that Kimmel and Short fought back. When they found out about the decoded intercepts that they'd been denied, they fought for many years. And Admiral Kimmel even wrote a book. It was ignored by mainstream media. It's called Admiral Kimmel's Story, published in 1955. Well, the reason that nobody got demoted or punished on 9/11, nobody in NORAD,
that's
an inheritance from Pearl Harbor. They said, hey, these military guys, they bite back. We're not going to scapegoat the military in the future. We're just going to let them go.
Well, of course,
dig up the truth.
the government was even more deeply involved in planning 9/11 than it was in allowing the Japanese to attack Pearl Harbor. We actually made 9/11 happen. We allowed Pearl Harbor to occur.
You're absolutely right. They're much more hands-on with our false flags nowadays.
But, you know, this is all terrible stain on the legacy of FDR, really, truly. I mean, you would have thought he could have persuaded the American people, but I think he believed it was beyond the potential for reason and rationality to prevail. There had to be a dramatic incident in order to galvanize the American people to enter these wars.
That's right, because a Gallup poll had shown that 80% of the American people did not want to send their sons to die in another European war. That's why he needed, a multi-Lusitania incident that would unmistakably clearly send a signal to Americans that they had to enlist and fight.
Yes, and we'll talk greater about 9/11, of course, when we get there.
Mm-hmm.
Here's, of course, the next intervention in slide number 13, which was the Korean conflict. I'm sure you have quite a lot to tell us about that, too, James.
Yeah, again, to set the context, okay, the war begins in the summer of 1950. Korea, which had been a protectorate of Japan during World War II, was divided into North and South Korea. The communists occupied the North. We occupied the South. We left in 1949. In the summer of 1950, Kim Il-sung and the communists invaded the South. It was a UN war. The United States troops went to the defense of South Korea under UN mandate. It was a bloody three-year war with over a million deaths, and it ended in a stalemate. Now, that's the public picture. But we need
the official account.
Yeah, we need to look behind the scenes. The first question to ask, just like we need to ask why were there ships in Pearl Harbor, we need to ask why was Kim Il-sung and the communists in power in North Korea to begin with? And the answer is that the United States really put them there. During World War II, Stalin and the Soviet Union maintained a non-aggression pact with Japan. They did not fight Japan, but at the big three conferences, you know, Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin of Yalta and Tehran, Roosevelt asked Stalin, would you break your non-aggression pact with Japan? And Stalin said, I'll do that under one condition. The United States has to provide my Far Eastern Army with everything it needs to fight a war against Japan. I want all the tanks, jeeps, ammo, and et cetera, to fight that war. So we sent him 600 shiploads of Lend-Lease for the express purpose of fighting Japan. We even diverted ships from General MacArthur.
How many shiploads? 600?
600 to fight Japan.
Oh, James, this is stunning.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. Stalin was very tricky. He waited until Japan was beaten to enter the war. Stalin did not send Russian troops into the Far East until after we dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Japan was suing for peace 5 days before Japan formally surrendered. Russia sent its troops into the Pacific War. Now, we'd won the war, but we treated him as if he was the co-victor, and we allowed him to occupy North Korea. It was ridiculous. He was an aggressor. Remember, he invaded Poland in September of 1939, just like the Germans. He was an aggressor, but we let him take over North Korea. We also set up a war scenario there because Stalin equipped Kim Il-sung with hundreds of tanks, a massive army with hundreds of fighters and bombers, MiGs. When we left South Korea, we only left them with rifles, you know, and a little artillery. They didn't have a single tank. They didn't have a single anti-tank gun. They didn't have combat-worthy aircraft. And in January of 1950, after we'd left South Korea and Mao Zedong had consolidated power in Kim's rear, taking over China, Kim Il-sung announced this was going to be the year of reunification for Korea. Now, a couple interesting quotes come up in early 1950. Dean Acheson, the Secretary of State, very Illuminati, Council on Foreign Relations, secret societies, the whole bit, gave a speech to the National Press Club, and he outlined America's defensive perimeter. And this interesting line, Japan was inside the perimeter, South Korea was outside, and he said that if South Korea ever got attacked, it would have to rely on the United Nations. Now, Jim, you probably heard that famous quote from James P. Warburg where he says, we shall have world government whether you like it or not. Like, remember that quote? By conquest or by consent? Have you heard that quote from James P. Warburg? Yeah. Son of Paul Warburg, the Federal Reserve's founder. He gave that quote in February of 1950. These guys knew war was coming. The Korean War was essentially fought to validate the United Nations as a peacekeeper. They wanted to shove the UN world government down our throats. And I want to just give you a quote from Foreign Affairs, which is the Journal of the Council on Foreign Relations, which, of course, it was what my book Shadows of Power is about. And the Council of Foreign Relations is what dominates our presidential candidates for decades and which really sets our foreign policy. Here's what they wrote in their lead article for April 1952. It was called Korea in Perspective. And the author wrote, quote, the burden of my argument, based on the meaning of our experience in Korea, is that we have made historic progress towards the establishment of a viable system of collective security, unquote. From the CFR establishment viewpoint, the Korean War was not about fighting communism or victory. It was to establish the UN as a keeper of global peace. Now, that didn't work out in the long run, but that's what Korea was about. There's a secondary purpose I want to mention, but this is very much an exercise in the implementation of world government. He calls it collective security, but bear in mind, 90% of the troops came from America. Very few other countries contributed troops to that action.
I just note about this photograph, James, that those are kids. I mean, this is a sure sign that the North Koreans had lost the war because these are children. They're 12, 13 years old who would normally not even be in uniform other than if you were in the desperate last gasp of an effort to maintain a war activity for which you were severely depleted of personnel. So that's a rather revealing photograph all by itself.
It was a horrific war. As you know, the front moved from the south to the north and back to the middle again. China entered it. It was an extremely bloody conflict that went on for 3 years.
Chance, let's go to slide 14, too. This is also a Korean War image.
And that's another image of this is a very unnecessary war. Here we see American soldiers. And here's the other point I want to make about this war. There was another purpose besides validating the UN, and that was to take away from Congress the right to declare war. You know, Roosevelt had to get a declaration of war to go to World War II. Harry Truman did not bother to get a declaration of war to go to Korea. In fact, he didn't even consult the Congress. Why? Because we were now under the UN's mandate. And I want to give you an exact quote from Harry Truman. Here's what he said to the press, quote, we are not at war. This is a police action, unquote. quote. He didn't consult the Congress. He didn't consult the people. He sent the troops there, but he calls it a police action, not a war. He said it's not a war, but Jim, we had over 30,000 American dead, over 100,000 wounded. Tell them it's not a war, and more than 1 million Koreans dead.
James, you're making a point that's one of the worst I've ever heard about Harry Truman. Of course, he was kind of a down-to-earth guy. No one ever really expected him to serve as president, but for FDR's somewhat surprising death. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that he should have participated in this police action to exercise the executive authority to circumvent Congress is terrible because it set an awful precedent, yes, with which we've lived ever since.
That's absolutely right. And he was under the thumb of people like Dean Acheson and Robert Levitt, all the standard Rockefeller appointees that had been under Roosevelt. They created the Marshall Plan and all the other major events of his administration. But this was a big focus, validate the UN and take away from Congress its rights to declare war. We have not had a declaration of war since we got into the UN. So this was a major step, sending troops to Korea without the authority of Congress.
And, you know, I was raised to believe that the United States was a great hope for mankind. And I'm afraid that that aspiration has been severely torn and tattered today. And no longer does the United Nations represent man's best hope for peace.
No, I don't think it ever did. But the United States, you know, I grew up believing we were the bastion of freedom right into the Reagan years. And, you know, the Soviet Union, they were the Iron Curtain. They were the bad guys. They were the ones who had the gulag. And it's amazing to see us kind of switching hats, you know, ever since 9/11 and the war in the Middle East. We've been kind of the Darth Vader, and now Putin is starting to look like the good guy. And
right,
I feel like we're the animals at the end of the animal farm looking between the pigs and the farmers. They can't tell who the pig is and who the farmer is anymore.
Putin is the knight on the white horse, the knight in armor on a white stick. The United States is the evildoer, no doubt about it. Let's look at slide number 15, which is alleged to be a photograph of the attack by the North Koreans on the USS Turner Joy and Maddox, which all appears to have been completely fabricated. Lyndon would later say, for all he knew, they were shooting at whales out there.
That's right. August the 4th, 1964, it was alleged that the North Koreans had attacked our destroyers in the Tonkin Gulf.
North Vietnamese.
The Vietnamese, yes.
Yeah.
And I want to give you a quote, and we could actually, I guess we could advance the slides. We have a slide of the,
well, we're good,
of the Tonkin Gulf attack. And the quote I'm going to give you is from the next slide. We have a picture of the book In Love and War. And it was written by Jim Stockdale, who's a recipient of the Congressional Medal of Honor. And I just want to give you a quote from that book because he was in the Tonkin Gulf as a pilot. And he oversaw the scene of the alleged attack on August the 4th. He overflew it for 90 minutes before returning to the aircraft carrier Ticonderoga. So I'm going to give you his direct quote, okay? This is from Admiral Stockdale, returning to Ticonderoga. Here's what he wrote in his memoirs, quote, "Wheeling into the ready room I'd hurriedly left 3 hours before, I came face to face with about 10 assorted ship's company, air group and staff intelligence officers, all with sheepish grins on their faces. The mood of the group was mirthful. Obviously, they had some big joke. Tell me, what the hell's been going on out there? They laughingly asked. And if I know, I said, it's really a flap. The guy in the Maddox, which is one of these destroyers, air control radio, is giving blow-by-blow accounts, just like on Sunday. Turning left, turning right, torpedoes to the right of us, torpedoes to the left, boom, boom, boom. I got down there and shot at whatever they were shooting at. I came around towards the destroyers once, right on the deck, chasing some imaginary PT boat that said was running up behind them. Did you see any boats? Not a one. No boats, no boat wakes, no ricochets off boats, no boat gunfire, no torpedo wakes. Nothing but Black Sea and American firepower. For goodness sakes, I must be going crazy. How could all of that commotion been built up there without something being behind it?" Now, the next morning, Jim Stockdale was awoken by a young officer, and I'm going to continue his quotations. "Who are you?" I asked. "I'm the junior officer of the deck, sir. Captain sent me down to wake you." We just got a message from Washington telling us to prepare to launch strikes against the beach, sir. What's the idea of the strikes? Reprisal, sir. Reprisal for what? For last night's attack on the destroyer, sir, I flipped on my bed lamp and the young officer left. I felt like I'd been doused with ice water. How do I get in touch with the president? He's gone up half-cocked. We were about to launch a war under false pretenses, unquote, Admiral James Stockdale, winner of the Congressional Medal of Honor. And I don't need to tell you that 58,000 young Americans lost their lives.
And over 2 million Vietnamese.
Yes.
Let's go back to slide 16 and talk a bit more about this war, because we were picking up where the French had left. This was a colonial war for resources in Southeast Asia. And, you know, once again, the United States had no business being there except that it would be the exploitation of another nation's resources, which we have done again. And go back to Cuba, go back to the Maine. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we see again and again and again.
Yes, I've heard that they were the Rockefellers were even drilling offshore for oil deposits that had been reported, discovered there. But, you know, I think they also, just as the objectives of the Korean War were actually outside the boundaries of Korea, you know, they wanted to empower the UN and to take away our own right for Congress to declare war. I think some of the motivation for the Vietnam War certainly was to change America, to change our culture. You know, I was a hippie back then, and I used to hawk a street in this newspaper called the Real Paper. It was the hippie newspaper in Boston. Well, you know who the owner of the Real Paper was? It was David Rockefeller Jr. And I finished reading a book recently by Dave McGowan. I don't know if you've ever had him on The Real Deal.
He's a terrific guy now, recently deceased, the last.
Yeah, okay, I'm sorry. I knew he had cancer. I didn't know he passed
away. Yeah, he has.
But he wrote a terrific book called Weird Scenes in the Canyon, and
sure.
He talks about the infiltration of the whole hippie movement by CIA and military. It was quite amazing. You know, actually, we were talking about Tonkin Gulf. Jim Morrison of the Doors was the admiral
son.
He was the admiral in Tonkin Gulf. There was tremendous infiltration. And, you know, the original hippie was a guy named, according to legend, was a guy named Vito Polikas. He was the guy who brought the original topless strippers to the Sunset Strip. Well, you know, his uncle was actually an in-law of the Rockefellers. His daughter married Lawrence Rockefeller, who was the brother of David Rockefeller. There was this tremendous association between that whole movement, which really changed America significantly socially. The entire social trend in America was changed. And I think that was part of the motivation as well.
Needless to say, strippers have been around a whole lot longer.
Yeah. Well, really, I thought
in 1968, James, Walter Cronkite had a half an hour show on CBS.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed a map of the continental shelf off of Vietnam and how the international oil companies had already subdivided it and made their claims. And it would be years after the war that I'd occasionally see a little report in a paper about Dutch Mobile, for example, having leased this section of the shelf because it was expected to be a vast repository of oil.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the CIA became addicted to cocaine in Southeast Asia. And this began its career as the world's greatest drug-dealing entity the world has ever seen.
Yes, you know, one thing I've found about these wars, they're very multidimensional. I only talked briefly about the Spanish-American War motives. There were quite a few that I didn't even get into. You can link to my article from my website from that. But I found there's usually more than one purpose to a war. We talked about World War II, and, you know, one thing I didn't mention was that the Federal Reserve was created just 6 months before the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, which generated World War I. And, of course, World War II, we got the World Bank. And if we got a Third World War, you'd get a bank, a chip for the currency around the world. But all these wars seem to have complex aspects. Usually they're not after just one thing, but numerous things. And I would agree that that was certainly part of it.
James, I'm just delighted to have you here this evening. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my special guest, James Perloff. We'll take a break and we'll continue our review of false flag attacks in recent American history. We'll be right back.
Less than 3% of you people read books, but less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off your television sets, turn them off now, turn them off and leave them off.
Now say, with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority, that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22nd, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You're ready to make to come to the microphone, so you'll listen.
Sir.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, continuing my conversation with James Perloff, whose website is at jamesperloff.com. We're moving forward in history, where we're tracing, since the late 1800s, events that have been managed by the government to manipulate the American people into wars that would benefit the military, industrial base, and private corporations and the like. Here's one that had a rather different purpose in slide number 18, one the American people need to know more about. And this, of course, has to do with the attack on the USS Liberty in 1967. James, tell us about it.
Okay, well, this is what you might call the false flag that failed. 1967, of course, was the year of the Six-Day War between Israel and her Arab neighbors. And in 1967, the USS Liberty was a reconnaissance ship which was stationed off the coast of Egypt. And this is pretty much an unarmed ship. It only had four 50-caliber machine guns. The Israelis attacked it in unmarked planes, which is significant, and they attacked it with machine gun fire, napalm, cannons, and they also...
Torpedoes, yes.
Yeah, they launched torpedoes, one of which struck the ship. And we know from intercepts of their ground-to-air communications that they knew the ship was American. She was flying the American flag. Later on, they tried to claim that they thought it was an Egyptian ship, which is nonsense. This ship had American markings and an American flag. When they shot that flag down, they raised a huge ceremonial American flag, but they kept on shooting. They even machine gunned the lifeboats, which is a war crime.
Right.
And the purpose of this, evidently, we don't know for sure, I suppose, because the ship was not sunk. They bravely fought with the limited equipment they had. They patched together some communication equipment after the Israelis had destroyed the communication antennae, and they got off a message to the Sixth Fleet, and when the Israelis heard that the American fighters were on their way, which actually they weren't because President Lyndon Johnson recalled them, but when they heard that, they scattered because they were not intending to take on an enemy that would actually have to fight. But it would appear obvious that the purpose of trying to sink the Liberty would be to blame it upon the Egyptians, and then for the U.S. to come into the war on Israel's side and guarantee them victory. This would be the most obvious explanation of this incident. The other significant thing about it, Jim, is that it sets a trend of Israel attacking America and trying to make us think that Arabs did it to us.
Yeah, of course, the Israelis have a long history going back to the attack on the King George Hotel in 1946, yes, when a gang of Ergun terrorists dressed as Arabs bombed the hotel, brought about many casualties in their efforts to drive the British out of Palestine. Here we have a slide of the ship before and after the attack, and of course what killed at least some 34 and injured another 154. It was quite a catastrophe. It was a miracle that the ship remained afloat, and it looks to me very much as though Lyndon Johnson had intended that it should have sunk and was unhappy when that did not come to pass. Indicative of his low character as a commander-in-chief of the United States, where, although we're not discussing it here, he was the principal facilitator of the assassination of his predecessor, James, in order to become himself president of the United States.
Yes, and he certainly did order the recall of the rescue planes. And one thing that I learned from the website of the survivors of the USS Liberty, which is the number you see there on the ship, it's GTR5.com, is that the heroic captain of the Liberty, Captain McGonigal, he was forced to get his Congressional Medal of Honor and a naval shipyard. He's the only recipient of the Congressional Medal of Honor not to get White House recognition, which is a measuring stick of the power that Israel exerts over America. And, you know, Jim, I just want to say that a lot of people say, well, how could a tiny country like Israel exert this much influence over America? And the answer is that the power behind Israel is the House of Rothschild, which is the world's foremost financial dynasty, and that's why they exert so much influence. Israel is really their creation. Unfortunately, a lot of American Christians think it's God's creation, but we're not talking about biblical Israel here. We're talking about a modern political, geopolitical.
What up, slide 19, Chance? A nice counterexample is the British Commonwealth, James. I mean, England is a small country too, but it dominated most of the world for a very substantial period of 150, 200 years.
Correct.
The idea that Israel's power or influence should be measured by its geography is simply absurd. You're quite correct, of course, about the alliance with the Rothschilds, but they also have many allies in key positions, both politically and in terms of the media and Hollywood here in the United States, where Cynthia McKinney recently revealed that when a new congressperson comes to Washington, they're asked to sign a pledge to put the interests of Israel even ahead of those of the United States. And those who do not sign find themselves confronted with a well-financed alternative candidate, or may discover that they've been redistricted out of their seat in Congress. It's appalling. JFK directed that the World Jewish Congress be registered as a foreign agent, but since his assassination, no president has taken that up. And the American-Israeli Political Action Committee, they call themselves Public Affairs Committee, has never been so required when it's so obvious, as has been demonstrated time and time again, that they represent the interests of Israel, not that of the United States, and where they've subverted our government time and time again to take actions on behalf of Israel that are not only not beneficial to the United States, but actually catastrophically damaging.
Yes, this whole series of wars we're seeing in the Middle East are clearly, although, again, multidimensional. Yes, they're interested in oil and resources and propping up the dollar. But ultimately, what we've been doing is dismantling the enemies of Israel one by one. Afghanistan, Saddam Hussein, Gaddafi, they're after Assad now. We are definitely seeing the implementation of Theodore Herzl's vision of a greater Israel backed by the Rothschild. This is not something that is godly. And this is something that I constantly try to remind Christians of, that this is a Rothschild enterprise, not a God enterprise.
Yeah, I worry very much about evangelical Christians who are so dedicated to Israel that they too would place the interests of Israel ahead of those of the United States on what they take to be religious or theological grounds. But James, it's a colossal blunder.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, I'm writing an article now on the Scofield Reference Bible, which is actually a Bible that was specifically backed by the Zionists to persuade Christians that the return of the Jews to Israel was prophesied by the Bible, when in fact it is not. The return of the Jews to Israel happened under Nehemiah and Ezra, but their legacy was removed when they rejected Christ as Savior many years ago, and they're talking about rebuilding the temple. Well, Christ pronounced a curse on the temple, and they're talking about Christ ruling from the rebuilt Jewish temple and returning the Jewish sacrifice. No, the Bible says that's all over. The New Testament says we're done with that, and Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this earth." He said, if anyone says to look me in the inner rooms, don't believe it. Yet that's precisely what they've been teaching, and that's largely a result of the Scofield Reference Bible, which was pushed by Oxford University. After the Pope told Theodore Herzl he would not support a state of Israel, they turned to the Protestants, and unfortunately, they fell for the bait and started using that Bible because it was sold by the millions and in impressive leather-bound editions.
And, of course, the United Nations was also used as an instrument to help support the creation of Israel and a host of other related issues, some of which have their own theological ramifications.
Right. But it's, America has been the main force within the UN that's been supporting Israel, even to the fact of dozens of times vetoing UN resolutions against Israel.
So I know. Yeah. It's staggering. 80 or 90 times the United States has exercised a veto on a UN resolution censoring Israel for performance of actions that were completely improper, immoral, illegal, violations of human rights. The Israelis have done it again and again and again, and there has been the United States acting as their protector when we're supposed to be standing up for human rights and justice around the world. It's a shame, James, but it's the real history.
Yes, we've been doing that for a long, long time now. And Harry Truman, recognized Israel the day that it was declared its statehood. And a lot of people think that's the reason that he won that miracle election against Dewey, was that he was doing favors for the right people in power. I should mention that the two favorites right now for President Trump and Clinton are both very committed to Israel. In fact, Donald Trump is the only American celebrity I'm aware of that actually did a campaign commercial for Netanyahu to be played on Israeli television. If you go on YouTube and just look up Donald Trump Netanyahu TV commercial, you can see that played. So once again, we're getting Israeli firsters lined up for it to be the next potential United States president.
Well, we may have a disagreement here, because while I would agree with Hillary, who has a very heavy baggage to carry, including what we're about to talk about in relation to Benghazi and Libya, I think Trump has the capacity to reorient himself. I have been troubled by what he said in objection to the Iranian nuclear agreement, because we know that Iran was not pursuing nuclear weapons. Our own intel agencies, all 16, James, declared in 2007 that Iran was not pursuing nuclear weapons, reaffirmed the conclusion in 2011. Even the Mossad reported to the Israeli government in 2012 that Iran was not pursuing nuclear weapons. Just 3 weeks before, Netanyahu went to the United Nations and declared precisely the opposite. And you hear all this talk about the $150 billion. That's not American taxpayer money. That's Iran's own money that was frozen as a part of the sanctions, which turned out to be violations of Article 33 of the Geneva Conventions of 1949, which specifically state that no person may be punished for a crime they did not personally commit. These are these sanctions on Iran are a form of collective punishment that qualifies as a war crime. I am shocked. I wrote to 98 senators to make exactly these points, James, and I didn't receive a single response to what I was informing them.
Which is certainly a measure of the degree of influence that Israel has, just as you said. And let me just say, it's very clear that Iran represents no threat to the world any more than Iraq did when we were claiming that they had weapons of mass destruction that they were going to use against us.
James, Iran has not waged a war of aggression against another state since 1775, whereas the Constitution began its ratification in 1787. George Washington was inaugurated in 1789. For longer than the history of the United States as a democratic republic, Iran has not attacked any other nation. It's one of the great, most peaceful nations in the entire world, and the extent to which it's been demonized is simply stunning, totally unjust, and historically inaccurate.
Well, if they haven't attacked anyone for 20 years, I'd say they're about due to attack one. You know, like when a baseball player hasn't had a hit for a long time, they say it's due for a hit. I'm just joking with you.
1775.
Yeah, a real threat. Yeah, real major threat.
And, you know, yeah, it's all just simply appalling. And, you know, they even protest Iran testing ballistic missiles, which are perfectly conventional weapons. Any sovereign nation entitled to conventional weapons of self-defense.
Correct. Yes. You know,
I've been appalled by this. This is an area where I hope that Donald Trump will reach a state of greater enlightenment, because he's been among those who has been assailing the Iran agreement when it was long overdue. In fact, the sanctions should never have been imposed if this were a just world.
Right. Well, he has said some right things. He has said that he's pro Second Amendment. And from his talk, I assume on trade, I assume that he is would be anti TPP. Hillary sounds like she's on board for the entire Rothschild agenda. I don't see anything that she's against. I imagine she's the favorite as far as they're concerned. If Trump was to get in, I don't really have faith in the political process. I think that these presidential elections are prearranged. But if he did get in, I certainly prefer him, given some of these solid stands he's taken on certain of the issues.
Trump is the bull in the China shop. He's upset everyone. Both establishment, Republican and Democratic, have been very upset with him. But Hillary is going down in flames. You may not know, but even National News was reporting today that there were dozens of those emails that are so highly classified, the State Department cannot release them. They were characterized as top secret emails that she had on her personal server purely for convenience. And I tell you, James, this is going to be the last straw for Hillary. She is not going to win in Iowa. She is not going to win in New Hampshire. Bernie Sanders, believe it or not, is going to beat her in both of those contests, both in the caucuses in Iowa and in the primary in New Hampshire. It's shocking, but this is how it's playing out.
Yeah, I have no doubt whatsoever that the American people do not want Hillary Clinton, but I'm concerned with what the powers that be are planning and how they're going to go back to the drawing board on this, if they're going to try to resurrect her or put out some other candidate at the last second. We've seen people rise to the power at the top. I'll give you an example. Wendell Willkie got the Republican nomination in 1940, but, you know, 7 weeks before the nominating convention, only 3% of Republicans wanted him. And he was a lifelong Democrat. But there was a push from the J.P. Morgan run newspapers. They put his image everywhere, and he got that nomination. You never know who they're going to bring to the fore at the last second.
It looks as though it might be Michael Bloomberg, who's also a billionaire, of course, and apparently even many times more wealthy than Trump. But the obstacles for a candidate entering this late are quite imposing, James, and I wouldn't have any confidence that he'd be able to swing it. The best hope I think the Democrats would have would be for an open or brokered convention, but I think Bernie's going to have it sealed up. I mean, it's amazing, given his history, given he's a socialist, self-declared socialist, until you ponder that the programs that have made the greatest difference to the American people are socialist programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, unemployment insurance, workman's compensation. It's fairly stunning that the American people seem to be so fed up with the establishment that they're even willing to nominate a maverick like Sanders on one hand and potentially Trump on the other.
Right. So I think that they are going to have to do some fast work to change public perception through manipulation of the media, as they've done in the past, or even rig those Diebold voting machines. And I have a friend who attended the 2012 Republican convention as a delegate, and she saw the rules change at the last second. So Ron Paul's delegate, she was there as a Ron Paul representative. The Ron Paul delegates had their were thrown at the last second, so Ron Paul couldn't even get a nomination through a rules change at the last second. So these guys know how to play the political game.
It was outrageous. You're absolutely right, and completely disgusting. As is the next slide, the story you're going to tell us now about this bombing at a German or French cafe that led to an attack on Libya. Tell us about it, James.
Yes. Returning now from our hiatus from false flags, the next false flag was the bombing of a LaBelle discotheque in Germany, where dozens of U.S. servicemen were injured and a couple were killed. And U.S. intelligence picked up messages which they thought originated, what did originate in Libya, which they attributed to the Libyan government congratulating the terrorists. So as a result of this, Ronald Reagan bombed Libya, and some may recall that the bombings killed Muammar Gaddafi's adopted daughter.
Yeah, it was only an infant.
Yes.
And this is absurd. Anyone who knows the history of Libya is the most peaceful, friendly country in the entire world at the time. They had the highest standard of living in Africa. Gaddafi was sharing the wealth of the country with the people. Newly married couples got $46,000 gifts, national health care, national education. They had warehouses, James. Anyone who was hungry could go to a warehouse and have their needs fulfilled. If they had a medical problem couldn't be solved in Libya, the Libyan government would fly them abroad with a relative for treatment at the expense of the Libyan government. The idea that Libya would be engaged in terrorist acts is a manifest absurdity.
And so let's look at who really was behind this. And I'm going to quote from another book. This is the
Go to slide 21, Chance.
The Other Side of Deception by Victor Ostrovsky. I don't think we've got the slide for this book. He was a Mossad agent. And he explains what really happened with this incident. So let me just quote him. He says, quote, "A Trojan was a special communication device that could be planted by naval commandos deep inside enemy territory. This device would act as a relay station for misleading transmission made by the disinformation unit in the Mossad called LAP, standing for psychological warfare, and intended to be received by American listening stations. Originating from an IDF ship out at sea, the pre-recorded transmission can be picked up only by the Trojan. The device will then rebroadcast the transmission, one used by on a frequency used for official business in the enemy country, at which point the transmission would be finally picked up by American ears in Britain. The listeners would have no doubt they had intercepted a genuine communication, hence the name Trojan, reminiscent of the mythical Trojan horse. Using the Trojan, the Mossad tried to make it appear that a long series of terrorist orders were being transmitted to various Libyan embassies around the world. As the Mossad had hoped, the transmissions were deciphered by the Americans and construed as proof that the Libyans were sponsors of terrorism. Ultimately, the Americans fell for the Mossad ploy head over heels, dragging the British and Germans somewhat reluctantly in with them. Operation Trojan was one of the Mossad's greatest successes. It brought about the airstrike on Libya that President Reagan had promised, unquote, Victor Ostrovsky, former officer in the Mossad.
This is just a great tragedy. The Libyans had a wonderful culture, a wonderful mm-hmm. society, virtually no crime at all because no mm-hmm. one had any unmet needs, yeah. James. Gaddafi was a benevolent dictator. It's just sickening to me. I recently did a two-hour interview with a couple who'd been in Libya during mm-hmm. the attack on Gaddafi and the trashing the West destruction of Libyan society. And listening to it brings me to the verge of tears. I'm telling you, it was this awful, just simply god-awful, where they paid mercenaries to butcher people, to kill them. They paid them to chop them up. They paid them to burn them. It was just a disgrace. And today, Libya is a nation in chaos.
Right.
Gaddafi was going to turn, through the Great Waterworks Project, was going to turn the North Africa into a veritable oasis. But he also was introducing the gold dinar, which would have rapidly become the currency of
yes.
all of Africa, and the Rothschilds couldn't stand for that.
That's right. And, Jim, when I hear people say, I still hear Americans say, why don't the Muslims love us? I want to pop a gasket. We've destroyed and created so much chaos.
Yes.
That was the first step of the war on terror. And I wrote an article on my website. You know, I had this epiphany. I used to wonder why it was that Gorbachev brought about glasnost and we had that transition. I've got an article on my website. It's called Did the Cold War End So the War on Terror Could Begin? You know, in 1985, Gorbachev came to power. That was going to be the beginning of glasnost. 1986, the next year, Reagan bombs Libya. That's the first step of the war on terror. 1991, the Soviet Union breaks up. 1991, we fight the first land war in the Middle East. You know, when the Cold War ended, we should have had, hey, end of big time military spending. We can right. concentrate on domestic needs, but instead.
The peace dividend that somehow never showed up.
Yeah, we never got those dividends. Instead, the military industrial complex simply shifted from the Cold War to the war on terror, and it's become an unending one with the permanent threat of ISIS.
And your next slide shows how easily the American people are beguiled. Look at slide number 22. This is just stunning, James. Would you believe American people to this day, for the most part, don't understand how they were conned by this young woman?
It's the incubator babies. You know, it's what happened, of course, was that, as I understand it, the Kuwaitis were slant drilling some of the oil from Iraq. And April Glaspie, our ambassador, assured Saddam Hussein, when he inquired of her, that we would not intervene. Of course, we did. And
that's
April
right. Glaspie, we gave him the green light.
Yeah, gave him the green light. She's been had a box around her as far as talking to the media ever since. But the American people weren't sure they wanted to really invade Iraq over Kuwait. And so we had her.
You had to demonize the Iraqis.
Yeah. Nurse Niura gave testimony saying that the
Iraqi soldiers are throwing the babies out of incubators.
Right, they went into a hospital and threw babies out of incubators onto the concrete floor to die.
And the thing was that she was not a nurse. She was actually the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States. She had not been in Kuwait at the time, and she was trained in how to give this cheerful testimony by the public relations firm of Hill & Knowlton. It was all lie. It was it was not a false flag action, military action, as a false flag a psychological ploy to persuade us to go to war, a war that was completely unnecessary, as have these other ones. You know, Jim, I want to say something. I am not a peacenik. If there's a just war, if you've got a modern Attila the Hun threatening to invade us, I think we should stand up and fight him. I'm all for a just war. The problem is we're not seeing just wars. We're seeing Rothschild wars, one after another. And, of course, the 1991 Gulf War brought on this with incentive from this this girl's false testimony.
And James, I'm with you 100%. I'm a former commissioned officer in the U.S. Marine Corps.
Right.
I served from 62 to 1966. If there's a war our nation should be fighting, I support it. But right. We have become embroiled in a series of wars for the benefit of Israel that are actually not only not beneficial to the United States, but severely harmful. And this manipulation by George H.W. Bush was simply grotesque. And of course, his son would outdo him, as the next slide shows, number 23, because they brought us 9/11 with compliments of the CIA, the neocons, and the Department of Defense, which covered the project for a new American century, most of whom were dual U.S.-Israeli citizens and the Mossad.
Yes, and I don't mean to laugh at that. The 9/11, there's so much we could say. There was, as you mentioned, the project for a new American century. It's called for a new Pearl Harbor, by the way. I reviewed the movie Pearl Harbor in June of 2001. It had come out the previous month. I did not know PNAC had called for a new Pearl Harbor. And, of course, that September we got the new Pearl Harbor. But
James, the timing of the release of the film is not coincidental in relation to subsequent events.
I looked and I couldn't find another patriotic war movie that Touchstone Pictures had ever made. It was no coincidence they made. They wanted to rev up that public patriotic spirit.
That's right. Planting the seeds of what they would later claim was the new Pearl Harbor.
By the way, they released the movie Sergeant York about a guy who was was reluctant to join World War I and became a hero. They released that 10 weeks before Pearl Harbor. These things aren't coincidental. They time these things strategically.
Hollywood is deeply involved in the propaganda effort, especially on behalf of the Israelis. It's stunning.
They're satanic. But, you know, you look at 9/11, okay, you've got Building 7 collapsing at free fall speed, even though no plane hit it. You've got the hijackers turning out alive, half of them. And why doesn't the 9/11 Commission say who the hijackers really were? Why don't they investigate that? Why don't they ask why Building 7 fell? How could these pilots have struck the buildings at those speeds, which were well in excess of the speed limits of the planes, when they couldn't control a twin-engine Cessna at 65 miles an hour at those training schools? And I know if you've seen the video for pilots, by pilots for 9/11 Truth, their own pilots were experienced Boeing pilots, could not hit the Twin Towers at those speeds. And yet these hijackers who had never handled the controls of a 767 before hit dead center. No casualties, survived to talk about it. No survivors to talk about it. And, of course, you got the stand down. You've got the Pentagon being struck allegedly 38 minutes. That explosion occurred after the second tower. Where are fighter planes? We've been under attack. The nation's capital should be our highest defense priority. You've got Shel Silverstein buying the Twin Towers 6 months, or getting at least 6 weeks, before 9/11. He invested $124 million with the partners, and he got a $5 billion payout. You could pick it up, and there's so many things wrong with the story. We didn't know all of that the day it happened. It's time to collect this evidence. I didn't know.
In fact, I founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth in December of 2005, James, invited Steve Jones to be my co-chair, and gave the keynote address at the American Scholars Conference organized by Alex Jones in Los Angeles that June. And I have done many shows about 9/11 right here on The Real Deal. For example, episode number 100 was on the 9/11 crash sites with Major General Albert Stubblebine, U.S. Army retired, who had been in charge of all U.S. military signals and photographic intelligence. And we went through the evidence that none of those four planes crashed as advertised, that each of them had been fabricated or faked, albeit in different ways, which meant that none of the passengers aboard those planes died in crashes that did not take place, and therefore there were no suicide hijackers who caused them to crash, which means that the entire war on terror was predicated upon a false, actually provably false proposition, as you have been indicating yourself in your previous remarks.
Yeah, a very, very sophisticated operation. Jim, I have to say, when I first heard no plane theory a few years ago, I really thought, hey, these guys are, what are they trying to discredit the 9/11 truth movement? Nobody's going to believe that. But when I looked at the slow motion video of CNN's picture of,
entering the South Tower.
You see the aluminum wings and the aluminum tail vanish into the building, and some of the footage shows the nose cone emerging on the other side. You know,
yes.
I've seen pictures of nose cones that have been punched in by birds. How
right.
can you go through 14-inch steel columns that come out the other side? Something is really wrong. Jim, I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out how they created this.
Flight 175 was intersected with 8 different floors, which consisted of steel trusses connected at one end to the core columns, at the other to the external steel support columns, and filled with 4 to 8 inches of concrete. Since the buildings were 208 feet on a side, that meant each of those floors represented an acre of concrete. And as you observed, we know the effects of a commercial carrier in flight impacting with a bird that weighs only a few ounces. How about one of those steel trusses with an acre of concrete? I mean, the absurdities, James. We're talking about violations of the laws of physics that cannot happen. I've done more about this, not only in that show, but also in episode 103 with Dennis Camino going through 9/11, who is responsible and why, which gives a short course on the non-crash of any of the airliners. Two of them weren't even in the air that day, 11 and 77.
Mm-hmm.
And pilots established that Flight 93, for example, was over Champaign-Urbana after it had allegedly crashed in Shanksville.
Right.
And that Flight 175 was over Harrisburg and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, long after it had purportedly hit the South Tower, where I discovered FAA registration data that showed the planes that were used for those two flights, James, were not deregistered or formally taken out of service until 28 September 2005.
And I know the pilots for 9/11 Truth confirm what you're saying, that the ACARS messaging system showed that those planes were in exactly those locations.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Look at 24, slide 24, Chance, if you will. And yet this event was used to justify the complete transformation in American foreign policy from one in which, at least officially, we never attacked any nation that had not attacked us first, to one in which we became an aggressor nation and launched a series of actions against countries that had served as a counterbalance to Israel's exertion of influence in the Middle East. It's just appalling, James, how the American people have been played by 9/11 and earlier events. Those twin towers, by the way, were white elephants. They had problems with Tennessee. They were loaded with asbestos. They were under orders from the Port Authority that the asbestos had to be removed. But constructing steel scaffolding around 110-story buildings would have been exorbitantly expensive. You couldn't take them out by controlled demolition without exposing the asbestos and other particles to the atmosphere. But conveniently, a couple of terrorist attacks could lead to their complete and total demolition, and no one would utter a peep of protest about it.
Which reminds me of the fact that the Pentagon had reported 2.3 trillion missing the day before, and the attack of the Pentagon just conveniently took out the accountants who were looking into that.
That's right, in the West.
Multidimensional.
Which had been conveniently just reinforced. It was the only wing in the Pentagon that had been reinforced to withstand a nuclear blast, and it took out the West Wing and all those accountants. Of the 125 casualties, 36 were accountants, budget experts, financial analysts who were in the West Wing. I can hear Donald Rumsfeld giving the section chief instructions to get all the documents and records pertaining to the missing $2.3 trillion into the West Wing with all the experts so they could, track it down, because he'd been embarrassed by having to announce it the day before, actually setting them up for their own demise.
It's horrific. Again, a multidimensional false flag serving a lot of different purposes. Financial purposes, war-creating purposes, greater Israel purposes, the Patriot Act, the NDAA, destruction of our civil liberties. They got a lot of mileage out of this.
They did indeed, and they're still enduring the consequences. Let's look at slide number 25. Here you have trivializing the fact that no weapons of mass destruction were ever turned up in Iraq. He's looking in his office for those weapons of mass destruction, James.
You know, just in terms of flow, if we could actually even go to the next slide, because it ties right into it. I'm sure many of your viewers have seen the interview with General Wesley Clark when he admitted that on 2001, shortly after the attacks, he was informed by sources in the Pentagon that the Pentagon was planning to take out seven nations in the Middle East and North Africa, including Iraq and Libya and Syria and Iran. And of course, if you're going to take out those countries, you've already committed yourself to that, you're going to have to provide the public with a public pretext, just as they've done in the previous wars. There's always a pretext for war. So in the case of the Iraq war, it was weapons of mass destruction. Now, we know that even though Colin Powell asserted this, that they had weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, Scott Ritter, the chief UN weapons inspector, had already gotten a record saying they didn't have any. After the invasion, we couldn't find any weapons of mass destruction, and David Kaye, our chief weapons inspector for the U.S., acknowledged as such, and eventually the President of the United States and Colin Powell said, oh, we made an intelligence mistake, but hey, look, it's all okay, we're going to bring them freedom and democracy, you know? That's always the old...
Here we go back to slide 21, where Bush was trying to trivialize the fact that the justification for the invasion of Iraq had fallen flat. I mean, it's just shocking. 25, Chance, just 25. There he is, looking under his desk, under his furniture, for those weapons of mass destruction. I mean, what could we ever have a more disgraceful action by a president of the United States, James?
Well, I talked to a guy the other day, says each time we have a president, I think it can't get worse than it does, you know?
I know. That's
unreal. Yeah, this is pathetic. I mean, we have people, soldiers who have been wounded and killed, looking in a war where we're looking for weapons of mass destruction that don't exist, and he's making a joke out of this loss of life, to say nothing of the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who died. And these people never lifted a finger against us, as did the Libyans never do.
I know. Go back to 26, Chance. Just go one forward. And here you had, yes, Wesley Clark explained how when he returned from serving as Supreme Commander Allied Forces Europe, which means he was a commanding general of NATO, he returned to the Pentagon, and another general informed him initially that there was a plan to attack Iraq. And Wesley Clark said, why? You know, they had something to do with 9/11. He said, no, sir. He said, that's just the plan. And Clark said, well, keep me posted. And when he returned a month or so later, he saw the same general. And he asked, are we still planning to attack Iraq? And the general said, oh, no, sir. It's much worse now. I just got a memorandum from the Secretary of Defense. And Clark said, is it classified? He said, yes. Well, then don't show it to me, but tell me about it. He said, we're going to destabilize the governments of seven different countries in the next 5 years, beginning with Iraq and Libya, ending with Syria and Iran. And, you know, it's just appalling how we were just turning ourselves into the instrument of Israel to attack all the modern Arab states that served as a counterbalance and then go after the great Persian nation of Iran, which, as I've already emphasized, have not attacked any other nation since 1775.
Right. The country that has attacked us has been Israel. They attacked us with the USS Liberty, with the Lapel Discotheque, and 9/11. And by the way, of course, as you know, Jim, they've got hundreds of weapons of mass destruction. They've got hundreds and they refused to let them be inspected. And that was the official another official pretext for going into Iraq. Well, they won't let us see if they've got those weapons of mass destruction. Israel won't let us do it, but we have this double standard. What's good for the goose is not good for the gander.
James, according to U.S. foreign policy guidelines, we cannot give foreign aid to any nation that has undeclared weapons of mass destruction.
Well, they're violating that.
Israel has an enormous stockpile of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. by law, we are not allowed to give them foreign aid. Does that inhibit it from going forward?
No, and that's why you see these anomalies. You see the pro-Israeli anomaly everywhere. I think a good example, we're not going to go into the Holocaust here, but you probably know that recently an 87-year-old lady named Ursula Haverback was sent to prison because she said, to her knowledge, the Auschwitz camp was designed as a work camp and not an extermination camp.
Sure.
You know, you can deny the Holodomor, the Ukrainian Holocaust. You can deny the Armenian Holocaust. Nobody's going to punish you. In fact, Walter Duranty of the New York Times was given a Pulitzer Prize for denying the Ukrainian Holocaust back in the 30s. But you say anything against the Holocaust of World War II, you go to prison, even if you're pushing 90. So this just shows you who's calling the shots and who's the boss. The people, as Voltaire said, and I'm not a fan of Voltaire, but as he said, if you want to know who rules you, find out who you're not allowed to criticize.
Oh, you're absolutely right. In a book I published last year, a collection of essays on the moon landing, Paul McCartney, the first death of Saddam Hussein, the second death of Osama bin Laden, and the Holocaust. Together, four essays, three by world-class experts on the Holocaust. Thomas Dalton, PhD, who published Debating the Holocaust. Robert Forasson, PhD, perhaps a leading expert on the Holocaust. And Nick Kohlerstrom, PhD, who just published a book entitled Breaking the Spell about the Holocaust, for which he invited me to write the introduction, which I also published there, entitled The Holocaust Narrative, Politics, Trump Science, which anyone can find online. And it turns out that there were 236 references to 6 million Jews in dire straits or fear of loss of their lives before the Nuremberg Tribunal, beginning as early as 1890, James.
Right.
That the figure has no empirical or scientific foundation. Even the International Committee of the Red Cross, which was visiting all the camps and keeping meticulous records about who had died and their cause of death, totaled out, when they adjusted their figures in 1993, at 297,000 approximately. Not a single one who died from being put to death using gas in a special chamber. What would you believe? When Ernst Zundel was tried for Holocaust denial in Canada in 1985 and again in 1988, they could not produce a single witness to any Jew ever having been put to death by gas in any of those camps.
That's right. And, of course, he hired an expert in the design of gas chambers who went to Germany and found that there were all kinds of scientific evidence against it. For example, the doors were not airtight. You can't gas people to death with a non-airtight door, because the gas would leak outside and kill the guard. I mean, there was so much scientific evidence against
it. That's right. That's the Leitner report.
Yeah. And this, of course,
turns out that when Zyklon B is used in a chamber, it interacts with the walls and turns them blue.
Right.
Bodies that died from cyanide poisoning turn pink, but we have no reports of pink bodies. And the only chambers that turned blue were those that were used for delousing, which was done with Zyklon B to kill body lice to prevent the spread of typhus and dysentery. In other words, to keep the inmates healthy, because as you observe, these are labor camps and you can't get any work out of a corpse.
That's absolutely right. And this, of course, the exaggeration of this event was what led to the founding of the State of Israel, which we now find ourselves really subject to in fighting wars on behalf of. This was necessary to build up and propagandize to create that state, which is a Rothschild state. It's their little kingdom, and it's what they plan, again, to tie it all together. It's not just a plan for world government. They want greater Israel to be the capital of world government. And I might add that a lot of people do believe, myself included, that this mass migration of Middle Eastern refugees to Europe, part of the plan is to make space for greater Israel. I think we're seeing that unfold as well.
Oh, I think the creation of ISIS was part and parcel of that, to exert more pressure on Assad. In fact, we're going to get to that momentarily. Because the next slide, alas, number 27, shows that the Reagan attack on Libya was not the end of it. This is one of innumerable different reports about NATO attacking Libya with completely no justification whatsoever, slaughtering the Libyan people in the streets, paying mercenaries to murder them, then paying them again to cut them up, then paying them again to burn their bodies. I did an interview with Jimmy and Joanne Moriarty, who had been in Libya at the time, and their story is completely horrifying. Find the Real Deal episode on Hillary's Benghazi in the West, the decimation of Libya. This is just troubling, about as profoundly troubling as any of experience I've had, James, of interviewing a couple about an event, because this was a wonderful society, wonderful society, and we butchered them from head to toe.
Yeah, this is Luciferian and satanic. We take people that are doing well, that wish us no harm, and we destroy them on the flimsiest of pretexts, supposedly Gaddafi being a dictator, whatever they wanted to say. And, of course, we were backing the rebels. And you've summarized the situation very well. You've mentioned the fact that he wanted to introduce the gold dinar and the international Rothschild bankers wouldn't put up with that, so it was his turn to go. And, of course, you got Hillary Clinton's comment, we came, we saw, he died. And I think that they thought that it was going to be the same with Assad and Syria. He said, hey, look, this is a piece of cake. We knocked out Libya and Gaddafi. Now we're going to go to Syria. It's going to be a repeat. And so we'll claim that Assad is committing atrocities. And then
Look at the next slide, 28, as an illustration. They claimed Assad had used gas on his own people. Here are some of the bodies. But Russia produced a 50-page dossier that showed it had actually been done by the rebels, who appear to have been provided with the gas by Prince Bandar, also known as Bandar Bush of Saudi Arabia, that the whole thing was contrived and that Assad and his government had nothing to do with it. James, this is just another stunning illustration of the duplicity of the United States and its allies, especially Israel.
Yeah, we should mention that Assad had just invited weapons inspectors to come to Syria the day before this happened. So why would with the weapons inspectors in Syria would he suddenly decide to gas his own people? It makes no sense. And have you ever seen the movie Back to the Future? There's a bit in there which a lot of people might remember, where Biff says to the older McFly, George McFly, back in 1955, he says, McFly, your shoelaces are untied. And McFly looks down. And he says, McFly, he hits him. He says, aren't you ever going to learn? Well, aren't we Americans ever going to learn? After the Maine, the Lusitania, Tampico, Tonkin Gulf, incubator babies, and all these other fake stories, are we still going to believe it when they come up with these fake stories? Weapons of mass destruction never existed. We're time and time again. Are we going to believe sarin gas? This is McFly saying, hey, McFly, there's sarin gas attack down there. Take a look. We've got to go to war again. We've got to go to war. We've got to have airstrikes. And when Obama didn't get the airstrikes, because Americans had enough Middle East wars, they said, okay, 1 year later, he comes back. Well, okay, now we're not going to have war against Assad. We'll have war against the guys we were supporting last year, who we're now calling ISIS. And nobody in mainstream media is asking any questions like that. That should make sense.
Many Americans don't realize that ISIS was a creation of the United States, where Judicial Watch succeeded in a Freedom of Information Act and pried out from the government the documents from the Defense Intelligence Agency that created ISIS, where we have photographs of ISIS members sporting U.S. Army tattoos. We have a video that was hacked from an aide to General John McCain showing the taping of those phony beheading videos on a soundstage in Tel Aviv or even in Hollywood. The Iraqi army about a year ago shot down two UK cargo planes providing supplies to ISIS. And a week later, Iraqi popular forces shot down an American helicopter doing the same in Washington, D.C. ISIS is known as John McCain's army. Thank God for the intervention of Russia in Syria, which is standing up for truth and justice in the world, which the United States and Israel are not.
Yeah, I was a holdout on Russia and Putin for a long time. I'm an old-time Cold War mentality guy, and I'd read a book years ago by a defector named Anatoly Golitsyn, who predicted, before it happened, in 1984, he predicted the fall of the Berlin Wall and many events which took place, the liberalization of the Soviet Union, the rise to power of a Gorbachev-like figure. But he said this is all going to be a fake. In the end, they're going to return to Stalinism. But I think that's not the way it played out. I like Putin. I like his foreign policy. He's the first guy who talks sense. And you know what he says about the refugee crisis is the solution is not to relocate a million refugees to Germany. The solution is to let these people live at home, make peace at home, stamp out ISIS, which he's done more effectively in his first week there than we did in a whole year, and let people live in their own countries and communities. And I like the guy. I like what he's doing. Maybe behind the scenes, he's really answering to the same hidden powers. I don't know. But so far, he's the one world leader who's truly talking sense.
I agree with you 100%, James, and it looks to me as though we're experiencing immigration as a weapon of war.
Yes.
And, this mass immigration is intended to disrupt these societies, ancient, some of the world's most distinguished, by overwhelming them with vicious migrants who are unlawful. They're committing all kinds of sexual attacks, gang rapes, and the like. It's a complete disgrace. The latest report I have from Sweden is that they want to forcibly evict 80,000 migrants from their country, but their police force are simply overwhelmed, and they're not confident they're equal to the task. Well, I say, if they're not equal to the task, write Sweden off, because another distinguished culture is going to be wiped out.
Yeah, and if you want to get a hint of how the establishment feels about this, Time magazine just named Angela Merkel its person of the year, and they called her Chancellor of the World. That shows it that she's got the Rothschild stamp of approval. This is about the destruction of Europe. Israel would love to see that, because then you'll have Europeans fighting Muslims in their own country, and then they'll cheer, hope that's what they think, as the Israel's 4,000 tanks begin to attack surrounding countries.
Well, you know, James, I mean, obviously the right candidate would have been Donald Trump, but the establishment would never want to admit that he's by far the most fascinating and influential figure in the United States. Merkel has caved to political correctness. What she's doing is damaging German society. My understanding is the vast majority of Germans despise her with a passion. Here we turn to your new book, Truth as a Lonely Warrior. And please, James, take the last few minutes to give us a sketch of what you're doing here.
Okay. Truth as a Lonely Warrior is designed as a book you could give to a skeptic. It provides context. The first chapter is what we talked about tonight, the history of false flags. Second chapter is on the powers that be, the Council on Foreign Relations that runs our country. The third chapter, we talk about the Fed, how it's debauched the dollar and destroyed our economy. And we go on through media control, population control. We talk about weather control, vaccines, secret societies, the North American Union. I try to give people sort of a relatively short book, you know, about 300 pages to cover this, but I try to give people the full picture. And by the way, I also have a movie out, called Shadow Ring. It's produced by Free Mind Films. You go to freemindfilms.com to buy it. And it's an intro also. We have a lot of, people, we interview in that movie, like Ben Swan, Joyce Riley, Catherine Albrecht, J. Edward Griffin, Adam Kokesh, Pastor Chuck Baldwin, people from alternative media. I'm in the movie, but it's a primer. We just talk about false flags, the Fed, the powers that be, and media control, because that's all you can do in a two-hour movie. But those are the things I've been working on lately. But you'll find a lot of up-to-date blogs on my website, jamesperloff.com, and I'm on Twitter.
Well, James, I got to say, I think you're an excellent person. You have a great strength of character and a very keen mind, and I'm very impressed with your dedication in pursuing all of these issues. It's been a real pleasure to have you here tonight, because understanding our recent history and the extent to which the government has been systematically misleading the American people, not just in recent times, but in approximately 150 years of our history, is a lesson too important for the American public not to absorb, because otherwise we continue to play the sap to our own government. It's a disgrace. It's disgusting. And you've revealed it extremely well here this evening with me.
Yeah, we don't want to be George McFly looking at his shoelaces when Biff says to look down. We have to wise up, and knowing history validates that famous dictum, those who do not know history are doomed to repeat it. Americans have been doomed to repeat it, so it's time to wake Americans up to the entire context of current events and everything that's led up to them.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, thanking my special guest, James Perloff, for being here. Check out his website at jamesperloff.com, and all of you for watching.